will would only undercut the general will. Individual action outside the nationalistic state could only detract from the power of the state. Individual excellence would only undermine the leveling process necessary for transforming man. Unless, that is, individual excellence was yoked to the service of the state. That yoke would be termed bureaucracy. The term bureaucracy is a mashup of the French word bureau, meaning the material used to cover desks, and the Greek term kratos, meaning power. So the term itself literally meant desk power or office rule. Bureaucracy was already prevalent in France before the French Revolution, but the revolution created a bureaucracy of its own, despite its own insistence that such bureaucracy was an evil of the ancien regime. Proponents of state power quickly began to praise the rise of an expert bureaucracy that could do the people's will without, of course, consulting with the people, who were, after all, a bunch of rubes. Whereas Democrats like Alexis de Tocqueville considered the bureaucracy a new form of oppressive oligarchy, Hegel called bureaucrats the universal class, since their goal was to fulfill the general will. Bureaucrats were to be trained in ethics and organization, and if properly governed, people would naturally resonate to patriotism. The consciousness that my interest, both substantive and particular, is contained and preserved in another's, i.e., in the state's interest and end. Hegel's reverence for bureaucracy would later be deepened and broadened by German sociologist Max Faber, 1864 to 1920, who declared that merit-based bureaucracy could bring about a better world, predicting the exercise of control on the basis of knowledge. But didn't such an oligarchic worship of centralized control cut against the supposed foundations of the Enlightenment itself? Didn't individual rights come into direct conflict with a small clique of all-knowing experts ruling from above? The man who solved this conundrum was Auguste Comte, 1798 to 1857. Comte is often disparaged today based on his belief in pseudoscientific silliness like phrenology, the study of the shapes of skulls to determine differences among human beings. But we are still living in Comte's framework. Comte provided a philosophical basis for bureaucratic oligarchy, atheistic science. Widely considered the father of sociology, Comte believed that human development had begun with religious pseudo-authority, human beings paying attention to obscure moral codes they believed had come from God thanks to their own superstition. But during the French Revolution, power moved from the priests and the kings towards science. Now, Comte recognized that the French Revolution had been a failure, but only because human beings weren't capable of moving directly toward governance by science. The revolutionaries had made the mistake of seeking meaning in universal values like human rights. Those individual rights ran directly counter to the necessity and power of the state. But the revolution's failure demonstrated the truth. The only truths could be found in hard scientific fact, in scientific positivism. In 1822, Comte wrote his plan for the scientific work necessary to reorganize society. His suggestion then, as it was throughout his career, is that human knowledge could lead to the imposition of rational laws that could reorganize all of humanity. Expertise was the basis of governance. And all inquiries into transcendental values were worthless except insofar as they served man. Science was philosophy, was religion. All were the same. It made perfect sense, therefore, when Comte founded the Religion of Humanity, designed to fill the gap left by churchgoing. Comte's church never met with success. Turns out that banning God and worshiping at the altar of pseudoscience will take a toll on membership, but it set the groundwork for the era of high-minded Western progressivism. Continental progressivism, the philosophy of Hegel and Comte, among others, made its way across the Atlantic Ocean in the form of John Dewey, 1859 to 1952. A man that Professor Robert Horwitz described as the foremost American philosopher of democracy of the 20th century. Dewey believed that social science could be used to engineer a new world and a new humanity. Dewey thought that the great ill plaguing the United States was its materialism. Like Marx, Dewey said that production and consumption had locked human beings into a vicious cycle of meaninglessness. But there was good news. That cycle could be broken and without Marx's brutal class warfare. Instead, all that was needed was intelligence. If we were simply smart enough, we could solve all of our problems. As Dewey wrote, the most direct and effective way out of these evils is steady and systematic effort to develop that effective intelligence named scientific method in the case of human transactions. Dewey did recognize another problem, though. Science, he stated, is typically aimed at an agreed-upon end. We research how to stop cancer, for example, because we all agree that cancer is an evil that must be eradicated. So, what common end should unite us in politics? Is it freedom? Equality? Virtue? Certainly not. Dewey disowned such notions as universal truths, mocking the founders for their bizarre loyalty to immutable truths good at all times and places. Dewey's answer was simple. Ask Darwin. What, you may ask, does Darwin have to do with anything? Well, says Dewey, Darwin showed that everything changed and became more complex over time, and that was good. It was our job to facilitate human growth, physical growth, emotional growth, intellectual growth. Our purpose is to set free and to develop the capacities of human individuals without respect to race, sex, class, or economic status. But this raises yet another question. What about democracy? What about consent? What if I'm not interested in growing the way John Dewey thought I should be interested in growing? Well, then, I'm just not intelligent enough. The state should be able to scientifically investigate the various players in any democratic system and put its thumb on the scale on behalf of those associations that are most valuable for growth. Furthermore, the state ought to re-educate children toward the type of growth the intelligent bureaucrats have endorsed. Children are, in effect, the property of the state. Yet again, we ask, who will decide the direction of the state? Dewey's answer, in the end, is simple. We just don't know. Government must change and adapt toward the end of making its people better. Pragmatism is the watchword. Whatever works is moral. Government must use its means to promote empowering rights, things citizens need in order to grow. The state would shape the citizen, and the citizen would shape the state until, as in Hegel's thought, the two merged. The state is then the completed objective spirit, the externalized reason of man. It reconciles the principle of law and liberty, not by bringing some truce or external harmony between them, but by making the law the whole of the prevailing interest and controlling motive of the individual. The philosophy of scientifically based expertise proposed by Hegel and Comte and espoused by Dewey came to fruition in the administration of Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson studied Hegel. He was a devotee of Herbert Spencer, himself a fan of Comte, and the philosopher who actually coined the term survival of the fittest. And he thought that the American founding fathers had been wrong, that the social contract theory and inalienable rights of John Locke and Thomas Jefferson were a load of bunk. Liberty was malleable, changeable, just as Dewey said. No doubt we are meant to have liberty, but each generation must form its own conception of what liberty is. And government was in the business of progress, not in the business of protecting eternal truths. All that progressives ask or desire is permission, in an era when development, evolution is the scientific word, to interpret the Constitution according to the Darwinian principle. All they ask is recognition of the fact that a nation is a living thing and not a machine. In Wilson's vision, the community always took precedence over the individual. Scientifically minded experts could best run the country, and the president, you know, someone like Woodrow Wilson, could act as the repository of the Rousseauian general will. The president, Wilson stated, is at liberty both in law and conscience to be as big a man as he can. His capacity will set the limit. From now on, American government would no longer base itself on the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. It would base itself on the pragmatic progressivism of Dewey and Wilson, an ever-growing bureaucracy, self-assured and confident in its own scientific expertise and aware of its own authority to help shape the formation of the American people from the top down. The Cataclysm. In the absence of Judeo-Christian morality and Greek teleology, each of these visions offered a shining, exciting new purpose to humanity. The philosophy of the American founding represented the apex of a philosophy that could provide all four elements of meaning necessary for the building of a civilization: individual purpose and communal purpose, individual capacity and collective capacity. But romantic nationalism, collectivist redistributionism, and scientific progressivism did away with the individual need for meaning. The four elements of meaning collapsed downward into two: communal purpose and communal capacity. The individual virtually disappeared in each of these domains. Individuals were only valuable as members of the collective, as sources of the general will to be embodied in the unified culture of the state, as members of economic classes who could unite to overthrow the nature of humankind itself, as citizens to be cultivated by the state, their expertise to be placed in service of the greater good. And human beings did find meaning in the new systems. But the new systems of thought, unchecked by the old morality, unconstrained by the willingness of single individuals to stand up to the collective, could only end one way: in blood. The worst sins of the 19th and 20th centuries sprang from various combinations of romantic nationalism, collectivist redistributionism, and supposedly scientific governance. The most obvious example, of course, came in Germany. The regime of Otto von Bismarck was characterized by its embrace of romantic nationalism, which culminated in the unification of Germany, and Bismarck's subsequent focus on Kulturkampf, the cultural struggle for German solidarity. That struggle led Bismarck to crack down in fascistic fashion on German Catholics, whom he saw as a threat to his autocratic rule. The National Liberal Deputy, Georg Jung, summarized the principle of Kulturkampf well in the Prussian Landtag in May 1875. "Gentlemen, anyone who believes in our day and age that he must carry his religion around with him, anyone who feels obliged to wear a particular dress, who swears grotesque vows, who bands together in herds, and who, when all is said and done, swears unconditional loyalty to Rome, the bitterest enemy of our young German and Prussian glory. Such people can have no place in our state. This is why I say, away with them, as fast as possible." This was an early indicator of evil to come in Germany, and it was combined with collectivist redistributionism and the rise of an oligarchic regulatory regime. This combination, however, was seen as a model for a new sort of state. Woodrow Wilson praised Bismarck's system in 1887 as the most studied and most nearly perfected, and noted approvingly, "Almost the whole of the admirable system has been developed by kingly initiative." Romantic nationalism continued to animate the German national experience. Its chief expositor, ironically enough, was the British-born Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who warmed to Germany after hearing the romantic nationalist music of Richard Wagner, the ardent anti-Semite and virulent critic of Jewishness in music, the title of Wagner's most famous anti-Semitic tract. In that tract, Wagner posed the supposed rectitude and depth of Germanness directly against the evil of the nefarious Jew, stating, "Emancipation from the yoke of Judaism appears to us the greatest of necessities." Jews, said Wagner, were alien, their speech characterized by a creaking, squeaking, buzzing snuffle, their music artificial and plastic. Even conversion from Judaism could not relieve them of such characteristics. Felix Mendelssohn is Wagner's specific target of ire. Chamberlain not only bought fully into Wagner's Völkisch view, a populist romantic nationalism, he became friendly with Richard's nasty widow Cosima and expanded Wagner's dichotomy between Jewishness and Germanness into an entire worldview. That worldview took full effect in his bestseller, The Foundations of the 19th Century. In it, Chamberlain characterized world history as a titanic struggle between the Aryan races and the Jewish race. The book made Chamberlain an intimate of Kaiser Wilhelm II, who adored it. Wilhelm was reportedly taken with Chamberlain's notion that the Germanic race alone was the most vital, and that the present and future belonged to the German Reich, which was its strongest political organism. This philosophy embedded itself in the German psyche. When Germany surrendered after World War I and the Kaiser was ousted in a coup, romantic nationalism did not dissipate. It was buried lightly under the soil, where it festered. In the aftermath of World War I, the German national myth of the backstabbing outsiders who had given away a battle victory spread far and wide. Germany had been betrayed, the logic went, and only a united Germany, beyond democracy and liberalism, could rise again to defeat its enemies. It burst forth in full bloom with the Nazis. The Nazi regime promulgated the most extreme romantic nationalism in world history. Hundreds of thousands of Germans united in lockstep, cheering wildly at the sight of a dictator, greeting each other by hailing Hitler, hanging pictures of the Führer over their mantles. All of it was an obvious attempt to create a cult of personality, but it drew on deep-seated romantic nationalism embedded in the German mind since before the days of Wagner. Hitler himself had been entranced with that nationalism when, as a teenager, he heard Wagner in Vienna. As Hitler biographer Ian Kershaw writes, he wanted to become himself a new Wagner, the philosopher king, the genius, the supreme artist. And he also imbibed deeply from Chamberlain, finding inspiration in the Völkisch movement. Extreme nationalism, racial anti-Semitism, and mystical notions of a uniquely German social order with roots in the Teutonic past, resting on order, harmony, and hierarchy. As the Weimar Republic collapsed, and with the threat of transnational communist agitation on the move in Germany, romantic nationalism became paramount in Germany. Philosopher Martin Heidegger embodied the feelings of millions when he urged his students in 1933, "May you ceaselessly grow in courage to sacrifice yourselves for the salvation of the nation's essential being and the increase of its innermost strength and its polity. The Führer himself, and he alone, is the German reality, present and future, and its law. Heil Hitler." Hitler merely channeled the widespread belief that German Sturm und Drang could only be recovered through an emphasis on the essence of Germanness. Heidegger wrote in 1929, "Either we restore genuine forces and educators emanating from the native soil to our German spiritual life, or we abandon it definitely to the growing Jewification." In pure pseudoscientific language, He added that Germans had to realize the fundamental possibilities of the essence of the originally Germanic race. The appeal of such ideals may be confusing, but George Orwell brilliantly summed them up in a 1940 essay on Hitler's Mein Kampf. Hitler, because in his own joyless mind he feels it with exceptional strength, knows that human beings don't only want comfort, safety, short working hours, hygiene, birth control, and, in general, common sense. They also, at least intermittently, want struggle and self-sacrifice, not to mention drums, flags, and loyalty parades. The romance of tribe, as we will see, didn't end with the fall of the Nazis. Meanwhile, concurrent with the rise of romantic nationalism in Germany, the ideals of collectivist redistributionism took precedence in the East. The end of World War I marked the final breath of the Tsarist regime in Russia, and with it, the rise of Marxism. Vladimir Lenin, 1870 to 1924, had spent his entire life in pursuit of socialist revolution. He'd been arrested and exiled for it. He spent most of the First World War dreaming of the inevitable Marxist revolution that would unite class against nation and overthrow the existing order. But when the opportunity arose in his homeland, Lenin quickly shifted his activity toward the formation of a revolutionary vanguard in Russia, embracing and championing the passionate violence of Marx that Fabianism had subsumed. Marx himself had not been averse to the possibility of violent revolution. In 1848, writing about revolutions taking place within the Austrian Empire, Marx stated, "There is only one way in which the murderous death agonies of the old society and the bloody birth throes of the new society can be shortened, simplified, and concentrated, and that way is revolutionary terror." And of course, Marx had concluded his Communist Manifesto with a call to arms. "Their ends can be attained only by the forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions. Let the ruling classes tremble at a communistic revolution. The proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a world to win. Workers of all countries, unite." Drawing on Marx's writings about armed revolution, Lenin suggested a revolutionary terror to be followed by true democracy, a dictatorship of the proletariat. Sounding a lot like Bernie Sanders, Lenin wrote in 1917, "Democracy for an insignificant minority, democracy for the rich, that is the democracy of capitalist society." Instead, Lenin sought, on the one hand, immense expansion of democracy, which for the first time becomes democracy for the poor, democracy for the people, and not democracy for the moneybags. And on the other hand, a series of restrictions on the freedom of the oppressors, the exploiters, the capitalists. "We must suppress them in order to free humanity from wage slavery. Their resistance must be crushed by force. It is clear that there is no freedom and no democracy where there is suppression and where there is violence. Freedom required tyranny. Tyranny was freedom." The terror of Stalinism began with the terror of Leninism. Historian Richard Pipe states, "It is difficult to convey the vehemence with which communist leaders at this time called for the spilling of blood. Grigory Zinoviev, one of the original members of the Politburo, and later to be executed by Stalin after a show trial, bragged about the launch of the so-called Red Terror. 'We must carry along with us 90 million out of the 100 million of Soviet Russia's inhabitants. As for the rest, we have nothing to say to them. They must be annihilated.'" As Pipes points out, this constituted a sentence of death on 10 million human beings. Stalin would carry Lenin's bloody legacy further, of course. By the end of his life, Stalin was responsible for the murder of tens of millions of people under his rule, including 5 million people during the forcible starvation of Ukraine for agricultural collectivization from 1931 to 1934 alone. And in China, Mao Zedong would bring Stalinism to a new audience, in the process murdering some 65 million human beings, the vast majority during Mao's Great Leap Forward, an attempt to reshape human beings by collectivizing their property and returning them to the soil. He did, but only as corpses. Somewhere between 30 and 40 million people died of starvation. Mao openly bragged about burying alive 46,000 scholars. During the Cultural Revolution, Mao's forces committed atrocities upon intellectuals, and mirroring the USSR's gulags, Mao built a system of laogai that housed tens of millions of dissidents over the decades. Today, the North Korean gulag state mirrors the glorious heritage of its communist predecessors. While it is easy to revile the deeds of the Russian communists today, it is important to note the esteem in which they were held at the time. Walter Duranty of the New York Times won a Pulitzer Prize for covering up the crimes of the communists and repeating their propaganda, even though he knew that they were slaughtering their political opponents. Some seven decades later, the Times executive editor finally admitted that the work Duranty did, at least as much of it as I've read, was credulous, uncritical parroting of propaganda. It wasn't merely the press. As Jonah Goldberg notes in Liberal Fascism, nearly the entire liberal elite, including much of FDR's brain trust, had made the pilgrimage to Moscow to take admiring notes on the Soviet experiment. The experts were at the wheel in Moscow, these officials believed. As Stuart Chase, the father of the New Deal, stated, the communists didn't worry about grubby money. Instead, they were motivated by the burning zeal to create a new heaven and a new earth which flames in the breast of every good communist. John Dewey found the USSR wondrous, as did most of the top officials in the American labor movement. W.E.B. Du Bois gushed, I may be partially deceived and half-informed, but if what I have seen with my eyes and heard with my ears in Russia is Bolshevism, I am a Bolshevik. Until the USSR's fall, many on the mainstream left believed it to represent a viable ideology. Despite the fall of the USSR, the desire to find a new meaning in the collective remains, both in the United States and abroad. The romanticism about communism has never truly died on the American left. In 2017, the New York Times ran op-eds about why women had better sex under socialism, when communism inspired Americans, and why socialism's future may be its past. Today, we hear about the wonders of Chinese central planning, the great strength to be found in organized economies, the rising power in the East. Thomas Friedman of the New York Times regaled readers in 2009 with tales of China's mastery. There is only one thing worse than one-party autocracy, and that is one-party democracy, which is what we have in America today. One-party autocracy certainly has its drawbacks, but when it is led by a reasonably enlightened group of people, as China is today, it can also have great advantages. None of it is true over any serious length of time, but the desire for collective purpose and collective capacity runs strong. In fact, it runs so strong that Stalin remains an incredibly popular figure in Russia, decades after his death and half a century after his monstrous crimes against humanity were fully revealed. In 2017, a poll by the Levada Center showed that a plurality of Russians named Stalin the most outstanding person of all time. Modern Russian dictator Vladimir Putin, a former KGB officer, says that Stalin was a complex figure, adding that excessive demonization of Stalin is one of the ways Russia's enemies attack it. Even victims of Stalin's crimes miss the power and glory that came with collectivization of purpose. In her Nobel Prize-winning oral history, Secondhand Time, Svetlana Alexievich quotes a former communist factory worker imprisoned and beaten half to death by the regime. A year later, he was released. Then, during World War II, he met his interrogator who told him, "We share a motherland." As an old man, this cruelly wrong man said, "People always want to believe in something, in God or in technological progress. Today it's the market. When I go into my grandchildren's room, everything in there is foreign. The shirts, the jeans, the books, the music. Even their toothbrushes are imported. Their shelves are lined with empty cans of Coke and Pepsi. Savages. I want to die a communist. That's my final wish." The deep-seated need for collective purpose and capacity found its outlet in the United States in bureaucracy, the movement away from a government answerable to the population and toward a government run by so-called experts. But these experts weren't experts on human nature, it turns out. Instead, they used science as a catchword for political priorities that maximized centralization. In the realm of economics, this meant the rise of a federal government dedicated to the proposition that unfairness in life could be rectified through central planning. During the FDR administration, economic policy was set from the top. Ignoring the injunction by economically laissez-faire thinkers that no set of individuals can know more than the entire market at large, FDR and his cadre of geniuses lengthened the Great Depression by nearly a decade by manipulating the currency, setting wages and prices, and bullying those who objected into silence. As Harold L. Cole and Lee E. Ohanian of UCLA concluded, the economy was poised for a beautiful recovery, but that recovery was stalled by these misguided policies. Those misguided policies included FDR setting the price of gold based on his lucky number. Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau wrote in his diary, "If anybody ever knew how we really set the gold price, through a combination of lucky numbers, etc., I think they would be frightened." Ironically, as Cole points out, the fact that the Depression dragged on for years convinced generations of economists and lawmakers that capitalism could not be trusted to recover from depressions and that significant government intervention was required to achieve good outcomes. This enthusiasm for central planning led to particularly dark results in the areas of race and sex. Many of the most prominent proponents of the social science movement were devotees of so-called race science, the pseudoscience that suggested that all disparities were due to inborn traits and that the future of a society lay in its willingness to find a solution to the problem of undesirable populations. This pseudoscience led many of those same humanistic thought leaders to propose eugenics as a solution to societal ills. As historian Thomas Leonard writes, "The roster of progressives who advocated exclusion of hereditary inferiors reads like a who's who of American economic reform. They were joined by the founders of American sociology. Among these figures were Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Oliver Wendell Holmes." Teddy Roosevelt wrote in a letter in 1913 stating, "Society has no business to permit degenerates to reproduce their kind. Someday, we will realize that the prime duty, the inescapable duty of the good citizen of the right type, is to leave his or her blood behind him in the world, and that we have no business to permit the perpetuation of citizens of the wrong type." Wilson pushed for compulsory sterilization of those with Down syndrome in 1907 and signed a compulsory sterilization bill as governor of New Jersey in 1911. Holmes, a Supreme Court justice, was a philosophical pragmatist and devotee of Dewey. His 1927 decision in Buck v. Bell resonates down the ages for its evil embrace of state sterilization of supposedly unfit populations. "We have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices, often not felt to be such by those concerned, in order to prevent our being swamped with incompetence." Fully 16 states embraced eugenic sterilization during the 1920s and 1930s. Over the coming decades, the states would sterilize 60,000 people. In 1922, author Harry Laughlin proposed compulsory sterilization of millions of Americans. In return for calling for generational death of the physically and mentally disabled, as well as alcoholics, he received an appointment as expert for the House Committee on Immigration and Naturalization for Congress. He also testified on behalf of dramatically restricting immigration. In his book, he created a model eugenical sterilization law. 2 decades later, Karl Brandt, chief Nazi medical officer and Adolf Hitler's personal doctor, cited Laughlin and Buck in his defense at Nuremberg. And, of course, the creator of an organization that remains relevant down to our day favored eugenics as well, Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood. Sanger wrote in 1921 that the question of sterilizing the disabled was the most urgent problem today. In one of her speeches, she suggested the sterilization or quarantining of some 15 or 20 millions of our population who would, she put it rather gently, be organized into soldiers of defense, defending the unborn against their own disabilities. She declared birth control nothing more or less than the facilitation of the process of weeding out the unfit and of preventing the birth of defectives. For her work, Sanger was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize a staggering 31 times, twice as many times as Gandhi. Making a better world in this view meant living for the collective and, if necessary, compulsion on behalf of the collective. The exposure of the Nazi eugenics program stopped the American progressive eugenicists cold, but the drive for a centralized program of living, as proposed by bureaucrats, has never died. A world in ash. In World War II, all three of these prominent collectivist worldviews came into direct conflict, and somewhere between 50 and 80 million people died. Romantic nationalism engulfed Nazi Germany, along with a worship of centralized bureaucracy and scientific governance, and 6 million Jews were mowed down by German bullets or gassed in death camps. The Soviet Union saw its own population as fodder for the preservation of the state, sending its citizens to die on the front lines of Stalingrad with no guns in their hands, but guns at their backs. The United States interned 117,000 Japanese. By the end of the war, the great hope of the telos-free, godless enlightenment had faded from view. Or, more precisely, it had been buried under the mountains of corpses from World Wars I and II. The West was suddenly in crisis. Despite massive technological improvements, and in part because of such improvements, the human race had nearly wiped itself off the planet. Science had not solved the search for purpose. In fact, with the discovery of atomic weaponry, it seemed that the West had come to the brink of its own annihilation. The great dream of redefining human beings, discovering transcendent values without reference to God or universal purpose, seemed to have died. While some still held out hope in the West for the eventual triumph of the Soviet experiment, with the revelation of Stalin's crimes, that hope too faded. What would replace that hope now? Chapter 8. After the Fire. The world survived World War II, of course. Not only did the West survive, it got freer, richer, more prosperous than ever. Human wealth expanded exponentially. Lifespans increased. But there remained a hole at the center of Western civilization, a meaning-shaped hole. That hole has grown larger and larger in the decades since, a cancer eating away at our heart. We tried to fill it with the will to action. We tried to fill it with science. We tried to fill it with world-changing political activism. None of it provides us the meaning we seek. By the end of World War II, European optimism was dead and buried beneath 6 feet of human ash. The philosophies of the Europeans, Enlightenment ideals about the value of human beings and the need to move beyond God or Greek teleology, had ended in tragedy. Hitler claimed ideological forebears in Kant, Hegel, and Nietzsche. Stalin took his cues from Marx. The eugenicists took their ideas from Darwin and Comte. The post-Locke Enlightenment project had been a Tower of Babel with the common goal of supplanting reason for religion rather than seeking the congruence of the two. As the tower began to challenge God, its builders went to war with one another, speaking languages all their own. And then the tower fell, and the land was left barren. Europe had buried millions of its sons and daughters. The West had placed its bets on mankind and reaped the whirlwind. But God did not return. Magna Carta, the first great charter of Western liberties, was signed by King John in 1215 and set limits to monarchic powers based on regard to God and for the salvation of our soul and those of all our ancestors and heirs and unto the honor of God and the advancement of his holy church. Religious practice remained the norm in Europe until the advent of the middle of the 20th century. Then, as the children born around World War II reached adolescence, religious observance plummeted. Faith in human reason, too, had waned. After the catastrophic insanity of not one but two great wars, the biblical warning not to place faith in princes had been proved prescient. The Enlightenment's hope in mankind's collective capacity to better itself had collapsed. Without God, and without the collective, all that was left were individuals, alone. Thus, the philosophy of existentialism came to the fore. Existentialism truly began in the 19th century with Søren Kierkegaard, 1813 to 1855, a Danish philosopher bothered by the problem of Enlightenment reason, which he saw as arrogant. The notion that a universal ethical system could be discerned by human beings was a fool's errand, the idea that history was an unerring unfolding of Hegelian dialectics far too simplistic. The universe was cold and chaotic. Man's search for meaning could not begin with an attempt to look outward for that meaning. Kantian universalism was too hopeful, Comtean scientism far too self-assured. Instead, Kierkegaard posited that human beings had to find meaning by looking within. The system by which one chooses to live is a leap of faith, but in that leap, man finds his individual meaning. Subjectivity is the truth, Kierkegaard wrote. Objectively, there is no infinite decision or commitment, and so it is objectively correct to annul the difference between good and evil, as well as the law of non-contradiction and the difference between truth and untruth. Truth can be found in ourselves. To Kierkegaard, this meant making the leap of faith to believe in a God beyond man-made ethics, his famous teleological suspension of the ethical. Kierkegaard focused on passion as opposed to reason. He deemed passion the most important driving force in life and concluded, "The conclusions of passion are the only reliable ones." He hoped, of course, that the passionate leap would be toward the Christian God. But his belief system would lead not to God in the end, but to worship of subjectivity. If truth lay in the self, then all moral truth automatically became a matter of subjective interpretation. This was the view of Nietzsche, who stated that the greatest man would be he who can be the most solitary, the most concealed, the most divergent, the man beyond good and evil, the master of his virtues, and of superabundance of will. Precisely this shall be called greatness, as diversified as can be entire, as ample as can be full. But all truth was subjective, according to the existentialists, not merely moral truth. This was the view of Karl Jaspers, 1883 to 1969, a German philosopher who wrote, "All knowledge is interpretation." It was also the view of Martin Heidegger, 1889 to 1976, who suggested that the essence of being human was being, not reason or passion, but existence. While Descartes had suggested that proof and meaning in human existence could be predicated on thinking, I think, therefore I am, Heidegger contended that our identity was wrapped up purely in existence itself. What did this mean practically? It meant mostly deconstructing ancient notions of eternal truths and human reason, going all the way back to Plato and Aristotle. What would fill the gap? Authenticity, the true self, contemplating its own death and the meaninglessness of the universe taking hold of itself. Heidegger prophesied a time when the spiritual strength of the West fails and its joints crack, when this moribund semblance of a culture caves in and drags all forces into confusion and lets them suffocate in madness. He openly preached the power of will and saw a choice between the will to greatness and the acceptance of decline. Heidegger's extension of this individual idea, taking hold of oneself and our place in the world, may have led to his original association with the Nazis. The truest expositor of existentialism, however, was Jean-Paul Sartre, 1905 to 1980. Politically, Sartre was a committed Marxist. He spent his life bouncing between support for Soviet communism and Maoism. But his philosophical contributions lay more precisely in the realm of the individual. According to Sartre, unlike both the ancients and the Enlightenment philosophers, existence precedes essence. In other words, we are born and then constantly remake ourselves in the face of the world, rather than being subject to the dictates of human nature. There is no sure good or evil. There is merely the world we are granted, and it is our job to make and remake ourselves, utilizing our freedom to do so. So Sartre writes, "Nowhere is it written that the good exists, that we must be honest, that we must not lie. Because the fact is, we are on a plane where there are only men. If existence really does precede essence, there is no explaining things away by reference to a fixed and given human nature. In other words, there is no determinism. Man is free. Man is freedom. On the other hand, if God does not exist, we find no values or commands to turn to which legitimize our conduct. So, in the bright realm of values, we have no excuse behind us, nor justification before us. We are alone, with no excuses. That is the idea I shall try to convey when I say that man is condemned to be free. Condemned because he did not create himself, yet, in other respects, is free. Because once thrown into the world, he is responsible for everything he does." This is a beautifully expressed idea, an idea replete with the tragedy of existence, but hopeful about man's possibility of reaching within himself for something higher. But it also leaves human beings without a guidepost. It promises no communal purpose or communal capacity. It focuses almost entirely on the individual, but leaves individuals without any guide other than the guide within. Furthermore, Sartre's belief in an unfixed human nature opens the door to utopian schemes of all sorts. If we can merely change the system, as Marx argued, perhaps the new man will arrive, cloaked in glory. The new natural law. While Enlightenment worship of reason may have ended in tears during the first half of the 20th century, its continued faith in science was amply rewarded. There is no question that the pace of scientific discovery rapidly increased in the period following the Enlightenment, with the average life expectancy in Europe in 1850 at 36.3 years old. By 1950, that number had nearly doubled to 64.7. Science was the future. The philosophy of scientific government had resulted in the horrors of two world wars and the specter of centralized, tyrannical government. But the idea that science could free mankind was still in the offing in the post-war period. And why not? As John F. Kennedy put it in one of his last speeches in 1963, "Science is the most powerful means we have for the unification of knowledge, and a main obligation of its future must be to deal with problems which cut across boundaries, whether boundaries between the sciences, boundaries between nations, or boundaries between man's scientific and his humane concerns." The focus on science had radically shifted. Science had begun in the Francis Bacon philosophy as an aid toward the betterment of man's material conditions. It had morphed over time into an aid toward the betterment of man's moral condition, though not the source of morality itself. But now, with God out of the picture and the collective implicated in the worst crimes in human history, science was handed the task of creating a new morality, a new law. The existentialists had reduced human purpose to creation of subjective truth. Science provided the last remnant of objective truth in Western thought. Nature, then, was the answer. Investigation of nature became the purpose. The legacy of Western thought had relied on natural law, the idea of universal purposes discernible in the universe through the use of reason. Nature was not seen as a justification for behavior, but as a hint toward a broader pattern in creation. Things were designed with a purpose, and it was the job of free human beings to act in accordance with right reason in achieving that purpose. What we ought to do was inherent in what is. A hammer was made for hammering, a pen for writing, a human for reasoning. Human beings could reason about the good and then shape the world around them to achieve it. Now, however, a new form of natural law came to fruition, the belief that whatever occurred in nature was natural and therefore true. This was a far cry from the original natural law. It said that human beings were animals and that their purpose was to act according to their instincts, not their reason. But the newfound faith that science would take us to the stars and beyond was about to collapse. For while the ancients had counted on human reason to allow us to freely seek and find moral truths, while Judeo-Christian teachings had called on man to use reason to find God and free will to follow him, science now undermined reason and will. The first serious advocate of the position that human beings were no longer rational, free actors came from Sigmund Freud, 1856 to 1939. Freud was a charlatan, a phenomenal publicist, but a devastatingly terrible practicing psychologist. He was a quack who routinely prescribed measures damaging to patients, then wrote fictional papers bragging about his phenomenal results. In one 1896 lecture, he claimed that by uncovering childhood sexual trauma, he had healed some 18 patients. He later admitted he hadn't cured anyone. Freud himself stated, "I am actually not at all a man of science, not an observer, not an experimenter, not a thinker. I am, by temperament, nothing but a conquistador, an adventurer, if you want it translated, with all the curiosity, daring, and tenacity characteristic of a man of this sort." But Freud's radical theories about human nature became world famous. He submitted that religion was but a form of childhood neurosis from which the world had to recover. He suggested that the roots of religion lay in an ancient event during which a group of prehistoric brothers had killed their father. Dreams were a form of wish fulfillment. Behavior was a manifestation of unconscious desires. In general, people were governed by forces beyond their control. Mirroring Plato, Freud posited a tripartite soul. Plato suggested reason, spirit, and appetite, while Freud suggested superego, moral reason, ego, life experience militating between appetite and reason, and id, appetite. But where Plato suggested that man should work to ally spirit with reason to overcome appetite, Freud suggested that working to uncover unconscious forces shaping our id would be the best possible solution. In other words, Freud believed that we were all governed by forces we couldn't understand, absent psychoanalytic intervention. Freud's heavy focus here was on sexual neurosis. And while Freud thought that sexual neurosis could be sublimated, energies rechanneled toward more fruitful pursuits, it was only a short step to rejecting that sublimation in favor of freeing us from neurosis through sexual profligacy. Thus, Alfred Kinsey, 1894 to 1956, entered the public eye, riding a wave of enthusiasm for promiscuity and excuse-making for it. Kinsey was a zoologist at Indiana University, fascinated with the supposed hypocrisy of repressed Americans. Kinsey believed, unlike Freud, that human beings could only be freed by throwing off the shackles of Judeo-Christian morality. He was contemptuous of Freud's theories and, according to biographer and co-worker Wardle Pomeroy, shocked by the moral judgments Freud constantly made. In 1948, Kinsey came out with his groundbreaking book, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male. 5 years later, he returned with Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. These supposedly rigorous studies found that 85% of men and 48% of women had had premarital sex, and half of men and 4 in 10 women had cheated on their spouses. According to Kinsey, nearly 7 in 10 men had slept with prostitutes, 10% had been homosexual for a prolonged period of time, and 17% of males on farms had pursued sex with livestock. Kinsey also claimed that 95% of single women had had abortions, along with 25% of married women. Americans were, Kinsey argued, a rather bawdy lot. The first book flew off the shelves, selling 200,000 copies in 2 months alone. But the science Kinsey pursued was deeply flawed. As journalist Sue Ellen Browder explains, Kinsey's statistics weren't reflective of reality because his sample wasn't reflective of reality. Of his original 5,300 white male sample, at least 317 were sexually abused minors, several hundred male prostitutes, and hundreds were likely sex offenders in prison when they were interviewed. The interviewees were also self-selected, and those who opt into such studies tend to be more sexually profligate. Kinsey used similarly terrible methodology when surveying women. No wonder the chairman of the University of Chicago Committee on Statistics, W. Allen Wallace, scoffed at Kinsey's entire method of collecting and presenting the statistics. But the reality of Kinsey's methodology mattered less than his implicit promise. Human beings could be bettered by casting aside the vestiges of the old morality. And the best news of all was this. It was all natural. No more struggling to seek the natural law. No more utilizing reason to hem in biological urges. By becoming animal, we could become more free. If it felt good, not only should we do it, we had a biological imperative to do it. Forget striving for existential meaning. We could all find truth by being ourselves. This was Rousseau's argument for the noble savage taken to its biological extreme. And the basis for that argument would only grow stronger in the scientific community. Scientists would soon argue that the capacity for free choice itself was no longer present. That we were automatons, slaves to our biology, robots deceived by the sophisticated outgrowth of our own neurocircuitry. Harvard professor E.O. Wilson was perhaps the greatest advocate of this position. He posited that human beings had inescapable programming that made us behave in certain ways in response to our environment. Furthermore, through investigation of the interaction of that innate nature and the environment, we could fully predict human behavior. Culture was merely an outgrowth of that interaction. Darwinian evolution ruled the roost. Wilson called his theory of everything sociobiology. Sociobiology, he said, could provide the great consilience of science, merging neuroscience and evolutionary biology and physics, all of science, into a cohesive whole. So man's capacity disappeared. Man's purpose seemed to disappear as well. If human beings could change nothing, being non-free actors, and if David Hume's distinction between what is and what ought to be remained valid, if you couldn't learn what was moral from nature itself, then human beings were left with nothing but hedonism. They were creatures of pleasures and pain, animals rooted in biology, responding to stimuli. The Neo-Enlightenment. But many of the same scientists who promoted the mechanistic, materialist vision of human beings and the universe were unwilling, thankfully, to leave human beings utterly adrift. Instead, many of them clawed their way back to the roots of the Enlightenment. Just as Enlightenment thinkers had relied on the power of reason, they relied on the power of science. Supposedly, the human mind could once again reign supreme after analyzing the world around it. This search would provide human beings with meaning. By investigating the nature of the universe, we would finally understand its unity. Wilson himself declares that his goal is to resume the Enlightenment quest. When built from reality and reason alone, cleansed of superstition, all of knowledge might come together to form what in 1620 Francis Bacon, greatest of the Enlightenment's forerunners, termed the Empire of Man. Of course, as we have seen, the Enlightenment's reliance on reason unmoored from revelation, the assumption by its greatest thinkers that human beings could in fact derive ought from is and then impose the ought, led from the bloody streets of French revolutionary Paris to the thumping jackboots of Hitler. Wilson's optimism would have sounded far better in 1789 than it does in 2018. Nonetheless, neo-Enlightenment thinkers continue to trumpet a new purpose for mankind, discernible through science. As Wilson wrote, "Preferring a search for objective reality over revelation is another way of satisfying religious hunger. It aims to save the spirit, not by surrender, but by liberation of the human mind. Its central tenet, as Einstein knew, is the unification of knowledge. When we have unified enough certain knowledge, we will understand who we are and why we are here." Wilson rejects Aquinas and Kant. He rejects any attempt to create purpose or meaning on the back of transcendent and eternal values. Those values, he recognizes, depend largely on the notion of free will that modern science has apparently rejected. Instead, Wilson proposes a new sort of faith, faith in science. Now, we could easily ask at this point whether faith in science was not the faith that brought us eugenics and central planning. But Wilson has something else in mind. Not the scientific manipulation of human beings, but the gradual emergence of workable values in tune with the nature that defines us all. Wilson believes that ethics are an outgrowth of evolution itself in combination with environment. Culture is an effect, not a cause. Wilson explains the way things are. Wilson argues that the empiricist spots the value of an ethical system in its success. Ethics is conduct favored consistently enough throughout a society to be expressed as a code of principles. The rightness of an ethical system can be explained by its prevalence. But what about the fact that awful ethical systems have dominated throughout human history? What about the fact that billions live under tyranny, or that the religious bigotry that alienated Wilson from the church originally now thrives across the globe? What about the fact that instead of the world gradually surrendering to the beauties of transnational liberalism, as Francis Fukuyama suggested it would, clashes of civilization have broken out anew, in accordance with the theories of Samuel Huntington? What about the fact that certain constants that Wilson full-throatedly rejects have marked human experience and human morality, including the commonality of religious practice and its use as a basis for moral systems. This is where Wilson makes his leap of faith. The empiricist argument holds that if we explore the biological roots of moral behavior and explain their material origins and biases, we should be able to fashion a wise and enduring ethical consensus. Now, though, Wilson is using tools that are no longer at his disposal. Who decides what that wise and enduring consensus looks like? The Vox Populi, which worldview is more widely perceived to be correct. This is fully relativistic. Popularity cannot substitute for any reliable moral compass. And so Wilson slides back into Hegel. That which is right is imminent or will change to become more right. Wilson obliterates David Hume's argument that we cannot learn what we ought to do from what is in nature because there is no ought. There is only what is. And that can always change. According to Wilson, the evolution of human morality is not about human beings working to better the world, but about human beings acting as agents of information integration who spit out updated morals on a regular basis. Morality becomes an ensemble of many algorithms whose interlocking activities guide the mind across a landscape of nuanced moods and choices. This obviously leaves some serious questions unanswered. First, how ought we to live? There is no ought, there is only how we do live. But that gives us no purpose after all. Human beings were not fashioned to find meaning in being. Wilson offers us no help there. Second, Wilson uses an awful lot of active verbs to describe the quest for meaning. We are about to abandon natural selection, the process that created us, in order to direct our own evolution by volitional selection, he writes in The Meaning of Human Existence. But we are a bundle of neurons. Direct is an active verb when we, in truth, have no active role in defining what we do next. Can there truly be meaning when we cannot determine what we do next? If we are biological stones thrown through space, destined to land at a predetermined place and time? In the end, Wilson retreats into the existentialism of Sartre, though he lacks Sartre's stirring faith in man's will. We are, it seems, completely alone. And that, in my opinion, is a very good thing. It means we are completely free. Laid before us are new options scarcely dreamed of in earlier ages. But this is untrue by Wilson's own lights. All of our options have been foreclosed by Wilson's scientism. They are not ours, since we are just animals living without the freedom to have our own options. And they are not options, since nature commands, it does not request. Those options are nature's path laid before us, which we will unerringly trod, regardless of whether we believe we want to do so or not. When Wilson states, "We have enough intelligence, goodwill, generosity, and enterprise to turn Earth into a paradise both for ourselves and for the biosphere that gave us birth," he offers us no plausible reason what paradise constitutes, how we can actively pursue that paradise, or why we should do so, given that our lives matter approximately as much as the lives of the ants he originally studied. When Wilson states, "We need to understand ourselves in both evolutionary and psychological terms in order to plan a more rational, catastrophe-proof future," he strays from his own naturalistic, deterministic genealogy of morals and begins preaching something close to the transcendental values he supposedly deplores. Other thinkers seem to embrace transcendent enlightenment values more clearly and anti-scientifically. If the new science had foreclosed the possibility of free choice and will, advocates of scientism were willing to overlook that rather inconvenient fact. If the new science had called into question the possibility of universal human truths, advocates of scientism were willing to overlook that too. Instead, these neo-enlightenment thinkers returned to the premises of the Enlightenment in the name of science. The same enlightenment that had brought about scientific progress, they argued, had ushered in an age of universal morality as well. Take, for example, Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker. Pinker's book Enlightenment Now is a powerful ode to enlightenment values. Where Wilson discards Kant as anti-scientific, Pinker embraces Kant's call to understand. He also endorses in glowing terms the power of reason. The enlightenment principle that we can apply reason and sympathy to enhance human flourishing may seem obvious, trite, old-fashioned. I have come to realize that it is not. And Pinker is obviously correct in celebrating in voluminous fashion the outgrowth of human reason, the material gains that are its products. But Pinker does cheat just a bit. Most obviously, he seems to endorse versions of free will and truth that science can't justify. These versions spring from a Judeo-Christian tradition he rejects. He simultaneously embraces Enlightenment ideas that have Judeo-Christian roots and chops off those roots. Pinker treats the Enlightenment as a significant break from the thought that preceded it. That's not true, as we've seen. He also engages in the no true Scotsman fallacy. He labels Enlightenment thinkers like Rousseau, Herder, Schelling, and others members of a counter-Enlightenment, ignoring their commonalities with fellow Enlightenment thinkers and casting them off into the outer darkness. In a 400-page book about the Enlightenment, he never mentions the French Revolution, which, as we have seen, worshipped the cult of reason. Pinker wants to pluck the fruit of the Enlightenment without stepping in the manure. But the manure was heavily linked to precisely the worship of God-free reason that Pinker embraces. As Yoram Hazony observes, in short, the principal advances that today's Enlightenment enthusiasts want to claim were set in motion much earlier. And it isn't at all clear how helpful the Enlightenment was once it arrived. More important, however, Pinker never explains why reason ought to triumph. He assumes as self-evident the idea that material gain is the highest priority. He writes that human progress requires only the convictions that life is better than death, health is better than sickness, abundance is better than want, freedom is better than coercion, happiness is better than suffering, and knowledge is better than superstition and ignorance. This is circular reasoning. If you assume that Pinker is right, it turns out that Pinker is right. But he isn't right, at least not for most human beings. It all depends on the meaning of happiness, which Pinker contrasts with suffering, as though all happiness can be got from a 98.6 degree temperature, a hearty meal, and a steady supply of sex. But that's not what happiness actually constitutes. Human beings keep showing that they need something more. Man cannot live by quality of life indicators alone. Material human progress in the absence of spiritual fulfillment isn't enough. People need meaning. And so Pinker seems to miss the central question of his own book. He acknowledges that the appeal of regressive ideas is perennial, but can't seem to figure out why. If we are all material beings, merely looking for material well-being, we should embrace the Enlightenment merely for its utilitarian purposes. But we don't, because we aren't. He opens his book by retelling the story of a student who asked him precisely that question. Why should I live? According to Pinker, his answer went something like this. As a sentient being, you have the potential to flourish. You can refine your faculty of reason itself by learning and debating. You can seek explanations of the natural world through science and insight into the human condition through the arts and humanities. You can make the most of your capacity for pleasure and satisfaction, which allowed your ancestors to thrive and thereby allowed you to exist. You can appreciate the beauty and richness of the natural and cultural world. As the heir to billions of years of life perpetuating itself, you can perpetuate life in return. And because reason tells you that none of this is particular to you, you have the responsibility to provide to others what you expect for yourself. This isn't much of an answer. It offers a smorgasbord of choices, and then suggests that the smorgasbord itself provides meaning. But that wasn't the question. The question was why to choose from the smorgasbord in the first place. Pinker has no answer to that question, because it requires a reliance on universal truths outside the realm of human reason. And his half-hearted attempt to build morality on the supposed ethic of Kantian mutuality falls apart quickly. His statement that reason tells you all other human beings are human, and therefore you have a responsibility to treat them as you would treat yourself, is effectively a religious appeal, not a reasoned argument. Why not simply take what you want? Why not declare your tribe or class superior? Why not reason that your genetic offspring can only survive if you gain an advantage over others in accordance with the survival of the fittest? Before we laugh off such suggestions, review again the history of the 20th century. Pinker isn't alone in his quest to revitalize the ideas of the Enlightenment, and some of his colleagues look for moral truths in the dictates of reason as well. Michael Shermer, a historian of science and editor of Skeptic magazine, argues that there are real moral values out there to be discovered in human social nature. He considers himself a moral realist. How can we find those values? Shermer says they are inherent in the exercise of reason. So he states, we don't need God to tell us that the Holocaust was wrong. It simply was. Why? Because his morality places at its center the survival and flourishing of sentient beings. We all want to survive and flourish. It's in our nature. It's what evolution designed us to desire. Sam Harris, too, takes this view. He says that the primary value that makes life worth living and gives us meaning is the well-being of conscious creatures. Like Hobbes, who saw the key to human systems in our desire to seek pleasure and avoid pain, moral systems can be built on the basis of a utilitarian calculation about human survival and flourishing. But again, we all define human flourishing differently. Harris acknowledges the inherent vagary in the term. The concept of well-being is like the concept of physical health. It resists precise definition, and yet it is indispensable. But Harris assures us that there is every reason to think that this question has a finite range of answers. The moral landscape will increasingly be illuminated by science. But has it been? As Harris acknowledges, most of what constitutes human